Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On February 13th, 200 million Americans sat down to watch the Super Bowl. Now, if you are a true blue football fan, maybe it'll be marked in your memory as the Rams' first championship since they moved back to Los Angeles. If you're a hip-hop fan, maybe you'll remember the Super Bowl for its all-star halftime show featuring Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, and Eminem. But if you watch the Super Bowl for the ads, you'll probably remember it as the Crypto Bowl, because it seemed that every other ad was trying to get you to put your money in cryptocurrency. For example, one company just played a bouncing QR code that, when scanned, gave viewers $15 worth of Bitcoin. Another hired the comedian Larry David to portray himself as an idiot throughout history, saying no to the Declaration of Independence, saying no to the Sony Walkman, and finally saying no to crypto. And one company went serious. Very serious, with an epic soliloquy from none other than Matt Damon.
History is filled with almosts. With those who almost adventured, who almost achieved, but ultimately, for them it proved to be too much. Then there are others, the ones who embrace the moment and commit. And in these moments of truth, these men and women, these mere mortals, just like you and me, as they peer over the edge, they calm their minds and steel their nerves with four simple words that have been whispered by the intrepid since the time of the Romans. Fortune favors the brave.
Fortune favors the brave. It was, in fact, a saying in ancient Rome. Pliny the Younger quotes his uncle, Pliny the Elder, uttering it in AD 79, before setting off on an expedition to the recently destroyed city of Pompeii. Problem is, Pliny the Elder died on that expedition. And if on the day that aired you were indeed feeling brave, and you bought $100 worth of a cryptocurrency called Terra, well, today, you would have nothing at all. The coin's value went to zero in May. If you had bought $100 worth of Bitcoin on Super Bowl Sunday, you'd have $50 worth of Bitcoin today. A bit better, just a mere 50% wipeout. Except if you had deposited that Bitcoin on a platform called Celsius, because last month, Celsius froze all withdrawals after the Bitcoin crash left it on the brink of bankruptcy. You'd still own that Bitcoin in theory, but in practice, it's effectively worthless. As is two-thirds of the entire crypto market right now. Since it hit a $3 trillion peak in November 2021, the crypto market has imploded by two-thirds, an astonishing $2 trillion loss in the past year and a half. Which means that one in six Americans are feeling that pain, because according to a Pew Research Center survey, that's how many Americans say they have traded or invested in crypto. So today, we want to step back and ask, what has that all that money actually bought? And why has the market crashed seemingly so suddenly? And could the crypto market meltdown speed the way to full regulation of cryptocurrencies? And will that regulation, and this is key, actually protect both investors and technological innovation, while also preventing the predatory scams that are so prevalent in the cryptoverse? Well, a bit later this hour, we will hear from Hester Peirce, one of the five commissioners on the Securities and Exchange Commission. But first, let's start our crypto talk today with Molly White, a software engineer who has a blog called Web3 is Going Great, and that blog tracks some of the disasters of the crypto world. Molly, welcome to On Point.
Hi, happy to be here.
Are you feeling brave? Are you feeling fortunate and brave after the $2 trillion loss in the crypto markets? I'll let you answer that, Molly. How brave do you feel about crypto right now?
I mean, I wasn't feeling super brave about crypto to begin with. So I think probably not feeling so brave right now.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, you know, I will be perfectly honest. Even in my fascination with and reading of crypto, I still find it a difficult concept to fully understand. So I would actually like to spend the start of the show giving everyone a primer on what cryptocurrencies are. First of all, are they currencies? Are they investments? Are they commodities? What are they?
That's the age-old question, I think. I think it's fairly safe to say that they're not currencies, despite the name. They don't function particularly well as currencies because it's difficult to spend something that might double in value overnight or half in value overnight. The feature of a currency that you want is that it's a stable value, which none of the cryptocurrencies tend to be. It's also pretty unsafe to call it an investment, I think, in the same way that you probably wouldn't call going and playing roulette an investment. It's such a risky endeavor that I don't think it could responsibly be described as such. I usually refer to it as more of a speculative asset, you know, something that you can basically gamble on in the hopes that it might go up in value, but with the understanding that it very well might go to zero.
Okay, a speculative asset. So that's key to remember here in terms of your definition of it. So when you're buying a crypto asset, what exactly are you buying?
You are basically buying an electronic record. You know, there is no commodity behind it. There is no paper banknote. You are just, you know, investing in a record in a database somewhere.
A record in it, but a record of what, though?
A record that you own some number of a cryptocurrency token.
And what is that token?
It is basically there's nothing behind it. It is just a digital record that with enough people, you can sort of hope it has value. But, you know, the whole point of cryptocurrencies is that there is no actual currency behind it. There is no asset behind it. There is no company behind it necessarily that is producing something of value. It is really just a digital record that, you know, Alice owns 5 tokens of some sort that hopefully will have value tomorrow.
Mm. Well, I mean, many supporters of crypto would say the fact that it's not tethered, supposedly, to the actual economy is one of its strengths. We'll talk about that in a minute. But someone once defined crypto to me as a exceedingly rare mathematical event that, as you said, eventually gets some kind of value assigned to it. I mean, how does that mathematical event come around?
They're probably referring to the cryptography that underpins a lot of the system. So there are some features of blockchains that people have come to rely on, which is that, you know, once an entry is added to the blockchain, it's very difficult to remove it or modify it. And so people come to rely on that in the sense that transactions are not easily undone and they are very easy. You know, you can reasonably trust that they, you know, are what they say they were. The way that crypto is actually created, you know, that new Bitcoins are created, for example, is by a lot of computers all solving very sort of pointless math problems, hoping that they will be the one that gets the solution first so they can add a block to the chain, in which case they get rewarded with a cryptocurrency reward. And that is all, again, based in cryptography, but has, you know, little to do, I think, with the actual value of the token that is generated.
So, I mean, because this is where I have always stumbled with crypto, and that is, you know, in my rudimentary understanding of it, it seems to be a very resource extractive technology insofar as the power, the actual literal power that it takes to run all those computers to find the solution to that very, very challenging mathematical problem so that you get rewarded with a token, right? And something that's exclusively extractive and not, and doesn't seem to perform any productive function in return. I just don't understand how value gets assigned to that. Molly, help me out here.
I mean, I agree with you. You know, the math problems that these computers are solving to try to be rewarded with these crypto tokens are not actually, you know, generating value for society. There is no usefulness to those solutions being generated. The only use really that's happening is the record of transactions that are being verifiably added to the database. But, you know, you could definitely, I would argue that that does not justify the enormous energy costs that we're seeing with systems like Bitcoin and Ethereum today.
Okay. But then there must have been some sort of original dream or vision for the function of cryptocurrencies or some function that wasn't being fulfilled that crypto could when they were first created. Do you know what that is?
Yeah. So the hope with Bitcoin and then subsequent cryptocurrencies was to create a financial system that is separate from existing finance today. And the hope really was to create the system that would be censorship resistant. So, you know, people could not, governments and banks could not necessarily block you from sending money or receiving money. And the hope was also to basically become separate from the government system of currency, which a lot of early Bitcoiners and Bitcoiners today believe is flawed. You know, a lot of Bitcoiners believe that the system of monetary policy that's in use today is flawed. And so they believe that Bitcoin is a better system, despite the majority of economists disagreeing with that.
Right. You know, I can understand the criticisms of monetary systems and policies, but trying to create an alternative financial system that is by design supposedly not connected to anything real, that's the part I struggle with. But let's refocus on the actual real-world consequences right now of what's happening in the crypto market. That $2 trillion loss since November of 2021. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit. Period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about whether the crypto market ultra meltdown could pave the way for a more robust regulatory system around cryptocurrencies. And I'm joined today by Molly White. She's a software engineer and runs the blog Web3 is Going Great. In a moment, we're also going to hear from Hester Peirce, a commissioner on the Securities and Exchange Commission, who has a much more optimistic view of the the current and future, or the present and future of cryptocurrency. So that'll be coming up in a minute or two. But first, let's return back to the fact that 1 in 6 Americans have invested in crypto, and that's according to Pew Research Center. But the crypto craze hasn't swept across society evenly. A recent NBC poll found that half of men in the United States between the ages of 18 and 49, half of them said they have dabbled in crypto, the highest share of all demographic groups. A quarter of Black American investors owned cryptocurrencies at the start of this year, compared with only 15% of white investors. That's according to the Financial Times. Well, here's one listener's story.
My name is Amos Iriki. I am actually 40 now, and I am in Los Angeles. I want to say it was last year during Elon Musk's hype and the Dogecoin hype and all that kind of stuff. That's what happened. PayPal gave you the option to have it in your phone, so you can drop anything in there real quick and you have some money invested in crypto. Now, in my case, I saw it as a secondary kind of banking account, and I can get a little bit of dividends, kind of like, you know, like other people do with their real serious money. But in my case, just $20. I just happened to end up living in my car because of circumstances, because, you know, you're freaking LA. But this is what made me laugh, because I was in my car and able to get even more broker than I am. Something about the convenience. And then I think that's where it goes back to the PayPal thing. Like, I'm in my car and I'm still investing in crypto. But something about it just started, like, when people were talking about like hyping other coins and this, that, it just started drawing up red flags for me. It started sounding or feeling like something weird. And I was starting to sit there like and thinking of how much money was I truly making when I was investing here, but how much was I risking if all of a sudden tomorrow it wiped out? It all started to get like, I'm like, you know what? I think I'm good. And that's when I started taking a little bit of a step back. But sure enough, I just kept my eye on that little thing because it's embedded in PayPal, so it still showed me how much crypto's worth. And then it just plummeted. I'm like, whoa. And the worst part is that some of my friends, that they told me if I invested in crypto, because I'm a technological, somewhat savvy guy, I said, yeah. So they took it as, well, screw it, I'll invest in crypto. I don't know how much they lost in this. People that have, like, you know, they can invest a household worth, like a house worth of money, like $500,000. Yeah, of course they can take the fall of $500,000 because they have $500,000. We barely have 50 to invest. So yeah, that's what I, like I said, it's a Ponzi scheme for people that have more money to make than it is for any regular guy to say, I got something invested in it. Now, mind you, I do understand that it's also a financial transaction method, but even that, so the machine that mines the coin, that makes the transaction, kind of gets a certain small percentage, but still the electrical value of that is not worth it. So I'm like, this is all a setup. This is all not worth it. This is even environmentally an FU. And that's when I quit. One of my friends was like, that seems like a good investment for the future. And I'm like, I'm just playing with it. And that, before I even got to that, I'm just playing with it, they told me they have this much invested. I'm like, holy it lives off the hope of someone getting out of their situation. People that have money, they're not living off the hope. They're just like, well, if I make more money, cool. If not, well, that's the breaks. That's the breaks is not an option for the lower people. And the lower people are the ones that felt it the most with this.
That's listener Amos Iriki in Los Angeles. Molly, I mean, he calls it straight up a Ponzi scheme, is it?
It depends a little bit on the projects, I think, which ones are literally Ponzi schemes. But I understand why people make the broad comparison, because it does very much rely on this somewhat scammy system where money constantly needs to be flowing in, you know, real money needs to be flowing into the cryptocurrency ecosystem to prop up the prices, which is very reminiscent of a Ponzi scheme.
Huh. So that's the thing that really, again, confounds my brain. I'm going to say this 100 times during this show and just, you know, broadcast my ignorance to the world. The thing that concerns me is that, you know, we keep talking about the 1 in 6 Americans. Most of them are individual or retail investors, but they're sending their real money in when buying these crypto assets. But so like, but how does that work? Why does real money need to flow into a system that, as you said earlier, Molly, is supposed to be ideally separate from sort of existing financial systems in the real world?
Well, there is, I think the idea that cryptocurrency is separate from the traditional financial world has been shown to be flawed. I mean, we've seen the fact that it is heavily reliant on new real traditional money coming into the system. And we've also seen the fact that crypto prices track traditional finance pretty closely. I mean, as we've seen a downturn in the traditional stock market, we've also seen this crypto downturn. And I think it's hard to argue at this point that Bitcoin is completely divorced from that.
Yeah. But heavily reliant on real money flowing into the system to do what?
To speculate on the value of these crypto tokens. So you don't necessarily need real money to mine cryptocurrency, assuming that you already have the computer hardware and the electricity to do so. But the speculation that's happening is the primary aspect of the cryptocurrency ecosystem. And in order to do that, you need to be able to put something of value into the system to make your bets.
Something of value into the system, into a system that you've said inherently has no value. Okay. You followed a lot of these crypto businesses on your blog. Web3 is going great. Do you have a favorite story that can really help us understand what you're talking about?
I mean, I think the story that we've been seeing recently of the crypto platforms collapsing in succession is a very illustrative of the problems in the system. You know, we saw the collapse of a major cryptocurrency ecosystem with Terra, which you mentioned earlier. And when Terra collapsed, the ripple effects throughout the crypto ecosystem really illustrated how heavily dependent on one another these companies are. It's sort of like, you know, a small set of companies are all loaning money to one another with these highly leveraged agreements. And if one thing goes slightly wrong, we watch this cascading failure of Terra and then Celsius, Three Arrows Capital, and various other crypto firms that have now suspended withdrawals and, you know, declared bankruptcy in some cases. As the dominoes begin to fall, and it's, again, it's the retail investors who put their money in and can no longer get it out who are really getting hurt by this.
Okay, then you've also on your blog, you have some like really specific examples, some projects that have come out of ideas from cryptocurrency investors, like one where they tried to buy an island in Fiji.
Yes. Yeah. So you're referring to the Cryptoland project, which was a scheme by a group of people who wanted to buy a real physical island in Fiji and turn it into this blockchain themed paradise, sort of like if there was a blockchain Disneyland. And you could go and live there, or you could go to visit or go to a blockchain conference. And the primary marketing for this crypto project was an animated video that was honestly closer to any good parody. I mean, it was a fantastic parody of the crypto ecosystem, but it was unfortunately completely sincere.
Wow. Okay. Are you saying they didn't build their Cryptoland project after all?
So far, no luck there. They were trying to auction off plots of land, and at the time when they were really pushing this project, it would have been the equivalent of about $1.3 million for each plot of land. They only had one taker, which was an initial person who had sort of been brought on to hype the project, who supposedly bought a plot of land. But aside from that, they had very little interest, I think, because like with most crypto projects of this kind, there was very little in the way of actual planning. And, you know, they had done very little work that would make a reasonable person believe they could actually pull this off.
Huh. Well, some people appreciate what they see as the more democratic aspects of the crypto industry and the easier access that small investors might have to investing rather than in traditional financial markets. Anya Wood is one of those people. She called us from Hawaii, and she says she and her husband turned an initial investment in crypto of $500 into $60,000, which she and her husband used to move to Maui, redo their deck, and buy a hot tub.
I really like the democracy of cryptocurrency. Like, I'm able to make these investments early on in things that have that ability to go like 20x, 30x, 50x, that otherwise you have to be this like registered investor. You have to have millions and millions of dollars to be able to make that kind of return on investment.
So Anya has made some money, but recently, of course, it's not that 20x, 30x, or 50x, unless you're putting a negative sign in front of that 20, 30, and 50. But she remains optimistic.
Our portfolio has just gone from like 150K to 30-ish. And so we're just sort of holding on. We faced this back in 2018 when everything kind of went to almost nothing. And then it all bounced back. And it's just been really fun to use our intuition and invest and then spend that money on ways to make our lives more fun and enjoyable.
Well, joining us now is Hester Peirce. She's with us from Washington. She is a commissioner on the Securities and Exchange Commission, appointed by former President Donald Trump in 2018. And I should add, Hester joins us today speaking on her own behalf and not on behalf of the SEC as an organization or her fellow commissioners. Hester Peirce, welcome to On Point.
Magna, thanks so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
So first of all, tell me, what keeps you optimistic about the possibilities of crypto, even through this, you know, $2 trillion or market wipeout?
I think it's important to take a step back and think about what the defining characteristic of crypto is. And I think it's also important to remember that we can paint with a pretty broad brush and talk about crypto in general, but there are obviously many different aspects to it. And some of them are the ones that Molly was talking about, where, you know, it's just people saying this is the latest fad and I'm gonna carry out my fraud using the crypto label. But there is a lot of interesting experimentation also going on in the crypto space. So I think taking a step back, the idea is that typically we've had to look to intermediaries. We've had to run financial transactions through intermediaries, because otherwise you have no way of knowing that if you send money to someone else, that money is going to get to the other person. We want to solve for the double spend problem, that if it's an electronic transaction, you know, you could send something, but how do you know that person isn't also sending it to someone else? So crypto is an interesting way to remove the intermediaries and to solve this problem and allow people to interact peer-to-peer. And there are a lot of other interesting things that are happening in this space, smart contracts, which allow you to set up sort of automated payments that pay out based on the satisfaction of certain criteria that you can build into the code. So there's a lot of potential there. And I think it's important when we look at from a regulatory perspective, when I look at what's happening, I mean, one, I say we should have, as many people, including many people in the crypto industry, were calling for, we should have put a better regulatory framework in earlier. And I think that could have prevented some of the problems we see. And second, I think a lot of the problems that you're seeing play out actually are very consistent with problems that we see in the traditional financial system. There are problems related to large intermediaries. There are problems related to over-leverage, overexposure to certain counterparties. And these are things we're all familiar with. And you know, this is a reminder to all of us that just because you call something crypto doesn't mean that you won't run into the same kinds of problems you run into in the mm-hmm. traditional financial system if you have those same intermediaries doing those same things.
Right. I mean, perfectly frank, in my cynical mind, when it comes to any financial system, the lesson is creative people will always find new ways to make bad exotic products. But let me ask you,
that's exactly right.
But what do you think is the cause of this? Like, this is a spectacular meltdown that we're seeing right now, and it's happening at the same time where the overall global economy, the quote unquote real economy, is also getting a little more shaky. The two are not supposed to be linked. So, what's driving, the crypto crash?
I think there are a few things. One, you point to the macro situation, which I think is certainly part of it, and two, I think some cracks were obviously revealed in certain large intermediaries in the crypto space. And so I think, again, taking a step back and looking at what the long-term objective is of crypto is to remove a lot of those intermediaries and enable peer-to-peer transactions to happen. And so that is, that can solve some of the very problems that we're seeing now. If you have everything on chain, you have everything open source code, people can see exactly what's going on. It's when you don't have the transparency, when you have something happening inside a black box that's an intermediary, that you run into problems.
Okay, well, Molly White, I haven't forgotten about you. I want to hear more from you in just a minute. We're talking about the crypto market meltdown and whether it's going to lead to more robust regulation. We've got some comments coming in. Eric Isaacs on Twitter says, tulip craze, the third, this time it's stupider. That's what Eric calls it. Cecile says, the more I hear, the more I'm convinced that crypto is digital Beanie Babies, what with enhanced access to untraceable criminal activities. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are taking a look at that crypto market meltdown, the $2 trillion loss since the overall crypto market reached its market cap peak in November of 2021, and asking whether or not this might speed the way to more robust regulation of cryptocurrencies, and if so, what should that regulation look like? I'm joined today by Hester Peirce. She's a commissioner on the Securities and Exchange Commission, appointed by former President Donald Trump in 2018. And we need to note that Hester joins us speaking today on her own behalf, not on behalf of the SEC as an organization or on behalf of her fellow commissioners. Molly White joins us as well. She's a software engineer who maintains a blog called Web3 is Going Great. Now, Molly, you heard Hester just before the break talk about the technologies behind crypto that she finds as worthy of preservation and allowing people to do things that they can't do in the regular financial system. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, to use an old adage. What's your response to that, Molly?
I think the potential for innovation in crypto and with blockchain technology more generally has been quite overblown, and it has been used to some extent as an excuse to not heavily regulate the sector. Myself and a group of more than 20 other software engineers and technologists, along with more than 1,000 signatories from elsewhere in the industry, signed an open letter recently to Congress, just basically begging them to take a more skeptical approach towards regulating and legislating in the crypto ecosystem, because we feel that the technology really does not have the potential that its boosters have been claiming it has.
Hester, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that Molly is right to say that we should approach everything with skepticism. And I think that that's my general mantra. It's my mantra to investors as well. But I think that the question is, how can we establish a regulatory regime that achieves the objectives that we all want to achieve, better disclosure to make sure people know what it is they're buying, but also does allow for the experimentation. I think it's fine that Molly and her co-signatories on that letter don't think that the technology has much value. There are other people who think that it does, and that's how innovation happens. You get the clash of different ideas and we see what comes out of that. So I think what we can all agree, though, that we can build a regulatory framework within which that can happen in a way that prevents some of the bad outcomes that we've seen in recent weeks.
Yeah, and we will talk about what that regulatory framework might look like in a second, I promise. But I also want to hear from you, Hester, your response to Molly's overall analysis of... And you heard me struggle with it at the beginning of the show about like what exactly crypto is. And I keep coming back to the conclusion that it's a system, as far as I can understand, that creates no value, but it extracts value in terms of real dollars from people. And that's just sort of like a basic element of how it all works. I mean, do you see it differently?
I do see it differently. I think we can all make different choices about what we think is valuable and whatnot. And that's what makes the world go around, right? But there are a lot of people out there who think there is value to having a way to transfer value between two people without having an intermediary stand in the middle. And that's what a distributed ledger allows you to do. And so that can enable people to have... much the same way that they transfer cash from one person to another. When you pay me with cash, there's no record of that transaction. And so you maintain privacy, which I think is important for all of our financial transactions. And it also takes out the cost of having that middleman, that intermediary standing in the middle. It enables, right now, I think there are a lot of experiments with what it can be used for, but you can think of micropayments, you can think of tokenizing real assets, tokenizing securities to address some of the inefficiencies in the way securities are transferred, allowing for quicker settlement, which can actually take risk out of the system. So there are a lot of different people trying to think of different ways to use the technology. And some of those ways aren't going to work, but some of them will. So I really think it's important when you're looking at these tokens to not paint with one brush, but to actually look at what is the project, who's behind it, what are they building, what are their plans for it? Are they just planning to dump a bunch of tokens on the market, or are they actually building something? And that's why it is important for people like the listener Amos to listen to their red flags, but also, to investigate the individual things they're putting their money into.
Okay, so it seems to me that for the purposes of this conversation, the crux we're at is what the technology could be used for, which I hear you saying, Hester, versus what, at least in terms of what we see in the market, it has been used for.
No, I don't think that's totally fair. I think you've already seen that there are uses for this technology, the ability to transact with someone using code as the intermediary instead of as an institution as an intermediary. It changes the risk, but it takes a whole risk out of the system of having that third party in the middle. You have to look at what the code says and you have to see what's going to happen, but you have there's a much greater transparency there than there is in some of the existing technologies that the traditional financial system uses.
Okay, transparency if you can read and understand the code. But Molly, go ahead. Yeah.
I think that there is value, as Hester is saying, to the idea that people could transact privately online in a similar way as they could in person with cash. But I also think that that is not what is making up the vast majority of the crypto ecosystem. Cryptocurrency largely is not being used as a currency or as an asset that is being sent from person A to person B. It's mostly being used for speculation. And so I think it's a little bit strange to argue that there should be, you know, a light touch of regulation, as some legislators have been arguing, not necessarily Hester, to the cryptocurrency ecosystem because of that particular use case, which has not formed most of the actual activity in the space.
Well, what I'd like to do now, can I just jump in here for a second? Because
sure.
We have about 10 minutes left. And what I'd like to do now, actually, and Hester, you had given us a preview of this before, is talk about what regulation ought to look like, you know, moving forward. Because the sort of what crypto is conversation and debate, I would actually love to have that for several hours, but I want to use the last 10 minutes to talk about regulation here, because, you know, we've had listeners calling in, you know, saying something needs to be done. For example, Ryan Slater, who called us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, he told us about his experience. He first bought into crypto in 2013.
So I held on for about 2 years. I survived crash after crash after crash until I moved here to Albuquerque and I needed to make my rent and I was out of money. I hadn't been working because I'd been working on my screenplay and I needed to pay my rent. So I sold my 10.81 Bitcoin for about $2,000. So I sold it about 2 years later in January of 2016 when the price was about $200. I lost a ton of money, and I thought I just got to forget about it for the rest of my life.
Well, he didn't quite make it that long. A year and a half ago, he got back in.
It seemed like this is finally here to stay. I mean, people used to tell me I was an idiot when I was investing it in 2013. And now, like, people are saying, you know, you're an idiot if you're not. So I thought, okay, it's safe now. I can do it safely with some smaller coins like Ethereum. And so I convinced my wife it was safe. I wasn't going to lose anything. And I certainly did when Elon Musk tweeted that it was bad for the environment.
Now, what Ryan's referring to is that back in May of last year, Elon Musk tweeted that Tesla would stop accepting crypto as payment for its cars because Musk said he had concerns about the environment, and that sent the price of Bitcoin plunging 15%.
And that guy should be found guilty of manipulating the crypto market. What he did is completely illegal. And then, of course, he always buys when it tanks. So, he as he says, he may pump, but he never dumps. So he always buys when crypto goes down. And he can control the crypto market with his 80 million Twitter followers.
That's listener Ryan Slater in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So what should regulation look like? Well, just last month, we had a highly anticipated Senate proposal come out. It's going to be debated quite vigorously for a while, that would put federal oversight of the crypto industry under the aegis of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and not the SEC. Okay, so there's an important difference there. Molly, what do you think about that? That the Senator Cynthia Lummis and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand proposal says, nope, it's more like a commodity and therefore should be regulated as such.
I wasn't surprised to see that in their proposed legislation, mostly because Senator Lummis and to a lesser extent Senator Gillibrand have been extremely friendly to the cryptocurrency ecosystem. When that legislation was proposed, we saw, you know, it was practically like people were popping champagne across the cryptocurrency companies. They were so delighted with it, which I think says a lot about the potential regulations that were actually being proposed. I think more than anything, that proposed legislation seeks to solidify some of the looseness in the regulatory system that cryptocurrency companies have been enjoying to date.
Well, to your point, crypto lobbying groups, first of all, the money they're spending in Congress has gone up significantly, many millions of dollars, and they did praise the proposal. for example, Kristen Smith at the Blockchain Association, she's executive director there, she said the bill represents a milestone moment for crypto policy and a major step forward for the crypto industry in Washington. Now, Hester Peirce, the thing that first caught my attention about the Senate proposal is that the CFTC, unlike the SEC, doesn't have the same sort of how should I put it properly? Disclosure requirements as the SEC has for securities. Like, a CEO doesn't necessarily have to put their name on a document, and correct me if I'm wrong, with commodities, like they do with disclosures for the SEC. Now, you had called for transparency as one of the key things in regulating crypto a few minutes ago. So how does the proposal to have it regulated under the CFTC help with that transparency problem?
Well, first of all, that bill it's a very large bill. And I think one of the reasons that people were excited about it is because they have been calling for a regulatory framework for some time. And this is a good starting point. I think the senators have argued that it's a starting point for discussion. And so in turn, I can't weigh in on the legislation itself. In terms of CFTC, SEC, or banking regulators, they're, you know, each regulator has a different role to play in regulating crypto. And I think it's up to Congress ultimately to make those determinations. But there certainly, I mean, I think the areas we need to focus on, first, financial education is really important to remind people that with rewards, when you're taking risk, when you're going for large rewards, you're taking risk and you have to take that into account. Second, transparency is important. So I called, for example, for transparency in connection with initial coin offerings. When people are doing these coin offerings, what information do people who are buying those need? I put out a specific proposal on that. We can think about regulating stable coins, making sure that there are reserves backing the stable coins. We can think about how should exchanges that trade crypto be regulated? Should that be the SEC, the CFTC, or some combination of the two? There are a lot of different aspects that we can be working on concretely, and we can be doing some of that without congressional involvement. Some of it will require congressional involvement.
Well, just as a note here, Molly had mentioned that Senator Lummis is actually invested in Bitcoin, several hundred thousand dollars, and Senator Lummis has been transparent about that. But you can hear that there is actually sort of, again, like a fundamentals debate going on in Washington, because other members of the SEC, and again, Hester, I'm not going to ask you to comment specifically on them, but Chair Gary Gensler calls crypto securities, but here we have Senators Lummis and Gillibrand calling them commodities. I just want to know specifically, what's your opinion, Hester, individually? Do you think crypto is securities or commodities?
Well, I think everyone would agree that these are facts and circumstances determinations. And so you have to look at what actually a particular token carries with it. Does it carry governance rights? Does it carry some right to revenues? There are a lot of legal questions around how you assess whether or not something is a commodity or a security. But I think we can all agree that we can sit down and think about what our regulatory objectives are and what the best way to achieve those objectives is. And that might be a combined SEC, CFTC approach. It depends. And again, the Lummis-Gillibrand bill is big and it's nuanced and it has a role for the SEC. It has a role for the CFTC. I think banking regulators as well. So I think everyone's trying to figure out what is the best way of achieving these objectives. But I think the most important step is to take some steps toward regulatory clarity, which will be better for everyone.
Well, Molly, we have about 30 seconds left. There are some observers of the crypto industry who say the status quo would be better than the bill presented by Senators Lummis and Gillibrand. What do you, if you had one or two rules about what you think crypto regulation should look like, what would they be?
I think my strongest opinion is that regulators and legislators need to stop, with the idea that in order to not squash innovation, there should be very little regulation, because we've seen very little regulation and it has been an absolute disaster so far.
Well, Molly White, a software engineer who runs the blog Web3 is Going Great. Thank you so much for joining us today, Molly.
Thanks for having me.
And Hester Peirce, commissioner on the Securities and Exchange Commission appointed by former President Donald Trump in 2018. Hester, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.